Hi, everyone, and welcome to Academic Dean, where we connect with passionate college leaders who share their stories and viewpoints of higher education, especially lessons learned along the way. Academic Dean is sponsored by Myers-McRae Executive Search and Consulting. Now, here's your host, Dr. Dave Gercheck.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'd like to welcome Dr. Michael McDonough to our show. Dr. McDonough is the president of Raritan Valley Community College in Branchburg, New Jersey. Hi, Mike. So glad to have you on the podcast today.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Dave. I certainly appreciate the opportunity for the conversation.
Well, can you talk a little bit about your college and why students select your institution?
Sure. We are a mid-size comprehensive community college, about 7,000 students. We serve two counties in central New Jersey. And I think, like many community colleges, we attract students for a number of reasons. I certainly think affordability has one impact. I also think we serve those students that want to go on to a four-year institution, don't know what they want to do. So we provide a space to discover a sense of self, I think. We have a rapidly expanding workforce footprint. We have a prison program. We're in seven New Jersey State prisons, about 600 incarcerated students in that program. We have a 100-plus program for students with intellectual and physical disabilities. So I think, Dave, like a lot of institutions, we're reaching out. We're trying to bring people either back into the post-secondary landscape or inviting them in for the very first time.
What's new on campus?
So I think a couple of things. We are building an addition to our workforce training center and making significant commitments in the area of EV, automotive technology, and most interestingly, I think, in biomanufacturing processes. So we're building two clean rooms on campus. We have a series of industry partnerships. And so I think these are exciting opportunities for students to see what's going on in the world of gene therapy. It's real cutting edge medical technology. And at the same time, you know, wed an academic interest in science with a workforce training program and begin that career either in clean room technology, in medical lab technology, or transfer to one of our four-year partners. I think that's an exciting development on campus.
What do you mean by clean room technology?
So, for example, there are certain manufacturing processes that can only occur in a clean room environment. Computer chip manufacturing, T-cell manipulation of blood, and a host of other potential aseptic processes, Dave, that are critical in the biomanufacturing world. So an opportunity for students to learn how to properly gown, to learn how to handle material in that environment, to learn how to observe all of those protocols so that should they then go into industry, they really are already kind of highly skilled technicians.
I see. That makes a lot of sense. Where I was as a dean, I don't think we had anything that was moving into clean technology.
Yeah, it's the work they are doing, especially in the cancer field with T cell manipulation, is simply, it's inspiring. Mm. I'm not sure I could tell you the science, but the processes are simply remarkable.
Well, how's your college adapting then to the changing landscape of higher ed, especially in technology, excluding the clean technology environment?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Dave, right, that's a real consistent challenge along with enrollment and funding. The escalating costs of technology make it very difficult for us to keep pace. We have made investments in tools that allow students to navigate their own degree completion. And so we're seeing students accelerate their time here, saving money, and that's a good thing. We are always looking at classroom technology. We are always looking at those tools that provide critical supports for students. But quite frankly, in the era of funding that we're in, and I guess it's all depending on the state you live in, it is a challenge. It is expensive, and we don't want to do it at the cost of a tuition and fee schedule that is beyond our students. A significant challenge, and not one, Dave, that I think I'm happy that we have resolved. We have not.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're really trying to pay attention to the rising cost of education for sure. So how are you making it your campus more accessible and affordable for the students then?
So again, let's have an honest conversation, right? Let's be candid with each other. It remains a profound challenge.
Yeah.
As you might imagine, many of the students that seek out our institution are low-income students. They're often first generation, they are immigrants, or they are students of color. The challenges are significant. So we adopt a variety of strategies. Number one, we have challenged our foundation to raise more money for scholarships. It should never be the case that a student can't come to this institution because of money. That's simply not acceptable. So that's number one. Number two, the state has introduced some programs that are really designed as last dollar scholarships to help students, if they are eligible, to attend college. We've made an investment in hiring counselors and financial aid experts to try to really reach that population, to make sure that they understand that those opportunities are available. And third, and quite frankly, we have become extraordinarily political, and we are talking and persuading and not backing down from talking to both our county officials, because we are sponsored by the two counties, and to the legislators that represent our service district, and making it very clear to them that the unfair funding formulas need to be addressed. That's simply because we are a community college educating, I might add, over 43% of the state's undergraduates, yet we only receive 8% of state funding. That is unacceptable. That is shameful. And we need to raise our voices on behalf of our students and make it clear that funding must provide equity, access, and affordability.
That 43%, heck, that's a big, big number.
It is a big number. It's 188,000 students attend the 18 community colleges in New Jersey.
Holy cow.
And it used to be 220,000 about 6 or 7 years ago.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
How is your institution preparing students for today's workforce?
So I think there's two ways we're thinking about that. One is to develop an incredibly comprehensive workforce training division. It partners with business and industry. It offers industry valued credentials. It's accelerated. It's experiential learning, and they offer stackable credentials. That's one. The other, and the far more complicated and the far more challenging, is how do we look, Dave, at our traditional academic programs, and how do we make sure that those skills, those competencies that we believe are the product of both general education and majors, how do we make sure that those competencies and that those skills really do represent what business and industry says they want? How do we make sure that those students can leave this institution with a portfolio that will allow them that first kind of career moment and let them thrive in that landscape? And that's another challenge, right? So those are the two kinds of areas of progress we're trying to push forward here.
It's interesting. What career development resources are you offering your students then?
So I think that's been one of the major changes over the past decade. So very dangerous to let me talk, Dave. You need to cut me off.
No, this is interesting.
10 years ago, we would have given career advice to a student the last few months they were leaving. It's that sudden moment of, oh dear, I need to either transfer or get a job. So I think what we've done institutionally is flip that 180. So we begin now trying to reach every student during the orientation process that they must have a career counseling session, at least to recognize that the courses that they are planning hopefully lead towards potential career choices. We've also adopted a kind of a guided pathways model. So we try to align meta majors or clusters towards certain industry clusters as well. We've also made significant investments in trying to get students to take internships, externships, experiential, whatever nomenclature we're using. And the other thing that's been very interesting, we have a number of corporate funded programs in mentorship. And so these are corporations that are authentically interested in diversifying their employee pools. And so they've come to the institution and they link professionals in the field with our students. They tend to be year-long programs. And some of those students have then used that as an entrance into that profession. Most of them, Dave, and you're probably getting a sense, this college sits in the middle of one of the pharmaceutical capitals of America. Johnson & Johnson, Janssen, Bristol-Myers, Squibb, Roche are right across from the college. And so it's mainly in that area, although we're seeing it in other areas too. So I think that's been a wonderful development. We need to do much, much, much more.
That's really interesting. Can you highlight any unique or innovative programs that distinguishes your college from others?
So, I mean, I think we all like to think we're unique.
Yes.
I suppose, Dave, one of the unique signature programs is our prison program. So we have a partnership with Princeton and Rutgers. We are currently located in 7 state prisons. We teach about 600 incarcerated students. They are all pursuing a Raritan Valley Associate of Arts, liberal arts in general studies. If they are successful and complete that program, they automatically transition to a 4-year Rutgers program. The teaching faculty is Raritan's faculty, Rutgers faculty, and Princeton's faculty. We have 4 full-time administrators now. who direct that program. And Raritan Valley was one of the original Second Chance Pell colleges. So we were able to extend Pell grants to our incarcerated students four or five years ago. Now, of course, Congress has changed the legislation, making it available to everyone. We're now looking to try to add workforce training into the incarcerated population, a different set of challenges, right. And we're just in the beginning stages of that.
I see. Well, how is your college collaborating with local businesses to create mutually beneficial relationships to address the regional needs in your area?
Let me give you one example that I think is really one of our opportunities as well, Dave, for fiscal sustainability. So LabCorp is one of the biggest medical diagnostic testing services in the U.S., and they have a very large facility about a mile from the college. And both pre- and post-pandemic, they ran into a recruitment problem. They hire anyone from high school grad to a PhD to work in their medical lab technology division. It's a massive division. And eventually they came to us and said, would you start an associate of applied science in medical lab technology? Because we have critical labor market need. We're going to need literally hundreds of these folks. And I said, sure, you'll pay for it, right? And they did. And wow. So we just launched an AAS in medical lab technology. LabCorp has funded it. LabCorp will also be the clinical site for the summer experiential internships. And LabCorp will have the first opportunity to offer graduates a job. I think that's a model for us. We're now developing a like model with the clean room and with Janssen. That's a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson. We also have a partnership with our utility company. We have an electrical utility program. That's an AAS. If you successfully complete the program, you are hired by JCP&L as a line person. And that's a $90,000 a year starting salary.
Yeah, I offered that where I was as a dean. I don't think people realize that's such a phenomenal salary for these guys. It's a dangerous job, but oh my gosh, I never thought they made that much money.
And I think that's the challenge, Dave. I think people don't recognize some of the opportunities afforded by these careers.
Yeah.
Advanced manufacturing, once you begin to stack those credentials, it is an enormously well-paid position. Auto mechanics with really responsive dealerships are making six figures. So you're right. And that's a challenge because we still have the challenge of recruiting students into those pipelines. But you're right. Once they hear what the potential career earnings look like, I might consider that role too. But I don't want to climb poles in the winter.
Yeah, those are my exact words when I used to watch them in January climbing poles at 10 below. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
How do you see micro-credentials impacting the future of higher ed?
I think, for what it's worth, that this is one of those rare opportunities we have to really reimagine the post-secondary landscape. I think that we are too addicted to the four-year degree. And we imagine that that is the gold standard for everything. Now, I loved my undergraduate experience. And as a liberal artist, I don't ever want to see that go away. It's not an either or. However, I think micro-credentials are one of the future opportunities that we have to grab with both hands. It enhances our ability to partner with business and industry. I think, Dave, that eventually Congress is going to allow Pell to fund non-credit short-term training programs. I think it lets institutions like mine become a critical solution to some of our labor market needs. Nursing, for example, HVAC technology, there's an endless opportunity. I also think that these micro-credentials, badges, whatever the nomenclature is, I think there's a real dynamic opportunity to relook at pedagogy, both in non-credit and credit. Let's look at different pedagogical models. Let's look at refreshing how we might approach our teaching. I don't have the answers right. I don't have the exact concrete examples, but I have to believe that this cross-fertilization is terribly, there's a lot of advantage here. Let's get our hands dirty. Let's take a look.
Well, as a community college, how are you incorporating community service and civic engagement into the educational process?
So I'm very lucky here. I inherited a really nationally recognized signature service learning program. So we have a service learning program that tries to link what you're learning in the classroom to solving the problems in your community, whether that is working at the Martin Luther King Tutoring Center, whether it's working at the Adult Day Center for residents with Alzheimer's, or whether it's working at a not-for-profit bike organization that provides bicycles to children who don't have them. So we've got a long tradition of investing in service learning. And I think you're right. It is also civic engagement. We're an all-in campus democracy participant. We firmly believe, and you know, that's one of the unique differences, right? Community colleges are rooted in their community. And they're rooted also because our graduates tend to stay here. So our graduates, our students really need to own the community where they work and come to college. And we need to give them the tools to sustain these communities, to be responsible for these communities. I think it's critical that we provide students that opportunity alongside the credit and the non-credit opportunity. But I think that's, Dave, I think that's critical. And as unpopular as it is, it's especially critical today so that our students can navigate the noise of our democracy, the ambiguity of our democracy. Let them have the tools to navigate that. I think it's so important.
Well, it's obvious you love talking about Raritan, but I'm going to change up the topics here for just a little bit, and I want us to talk a little bit about you. So let's talk a teeny bit about, or can you share with my listeners, the path that led you to become the president at Raritan Valley Community College?
Sure, even though many of my friends and critics alike find that hard to believe, right? So I think it's remarkable that I'm here. I am really here in part because of a man named Mr. Ogden. So I grew up in the northwest of England. Mom and dad had both left school between the ages of 12 and 14. We were proudly working class. We didn't know that because everybody else was in the same position that we were. I went to a very large secondary modern school that was designed to meet the technical needs of city residents. And I had a simply magnificent English teacher by the name of Mr. Ogden, who said to me at one point, you know, if you stopped fooling around, you could go to university. Mr. Ogden also took me to the theater for the first time ever, and I couldn't believe that this existed. So, you know, at the time in England, it was all about your O levels. If you passed them, great. I did. I don't know how. I went to sixth form college. I passed my A levels, and I went to university, not knowing anything, and discovered that I loved that life. I thought that I couldn't believe that there were people who got paid, right, to do this. So, long story, I eventually made it to America. I had worked in America in the summer in college as a camp counselor, and fell in love with what is a stunningly magnificent and dynamic country. So I ended up getting a master's from Oklahoma State. Then I went to Penn State, got a PhD, and purely by accident, right, got a tenure track position and was an English professor at a small private four-year institution for 20 years.
Wow.
And loved it, right, was department chair. And, you know, small institutions are wonderful because you get to do everything and nobody tells you no, right? So it was a wonderful experience, but I noticed that we had started to hire some spectacular young teachers. And I thought, you know, it might be time to let someone else do this. So I applied for a job at a community college as a dean, as the dean of liberal arts, very large urban community college. And they offered me the job. How crazy is that? So I stayed there, became the provost there. And then after about 10 years there, for various reasons, saw this job. I applied. They foolishly gave me the job. And this is my 10th year here.
Holy cow. So you've been an academic leader for quite a few years then.
I am very old. And yes, I taught my first college course in the fall of 1981.
Wow.
English composition. And I'm sure I taught it very badly. I'm sorry to all those students.
Well, what's some of your biggest lessons you've learned as both a dean and as a community college president?
Well, I mean, it's going to sound right. It's going to sound ridiculous. It's going to sound a bit of a cliche. Be kind.
Mm. Right? No, that's good advice.
Practice grace. I'm here because people gave me second chances, third chances, right? Always meet. If somebody wants to meet and talk, meet them. It doesn't mean that you're going to say yes. But if you say no immediately to the opportunity, you'll never know what it was. And I think, you know, and this is a difficult one, right? But, you know, a lot of people who make it to my office sometimes are not in the best mood, are not in the best frame of mind. They certainly have a sincere belief sometimes that the institution has harmed them. Try to listen. Right. I mean, it, and I recognize it's difficult, But again, it comes back to that kindness, and recognize, titles bestow authority and bestow some degree of power. Exercise it on behalf of other people.
Well, what's your favorite part? What's your favorite part about being the president there?
Graduation. So community college graduations are unlike other graduations. For some of our students, this is the first time ever that there's a public recognition of them, right? This is their moment. My son came to Raritan Valley and he graduated here last semester.
Wow.
That was pretty special. But I think it's always right about the students. It's about watching them succeed in ways, Dave, that I would have given up. But they don't. They're remarkable. Doesn't mean they can't be a gigantic pain. But that's the best part, right? And colleagues. I love my colleagues. I love the conversations about what it is we do. I think this is so terribly important. I think higher education matters. And I think those of us who are in it should be honored to be in it and to make sure that it matters. Give it all. I love that. And when I don't, that'll be the signal to become the greeter at Walmart, which I really look forward to.
Well, here's my last question. What advice would you give a prospective student when choosing the right college or university for their education?
Yeah, that's a tough question. So I think ultimately you have to trust that inner voice, that instinctual kind of, I like it here, or this doesn't feel right. That's one thing. The second, I think, is to recognize that it's one choice in a lifetime of choices. So because you may begin here, that doesn't mean you're going to end here. But I think starting right is important. So pick that place where you think I can get a good start here.
Great, great advice. Great advice. Well, Mike, thanks so much for being on our show. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. And again, it was very kind of you to make the invitation. I enjoy meeting colleagues. It keeps me fresh and in the game. So I've really enjoyed it, Dave. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, that wraps up today's episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. And make sure to visit our website at academicdean.com. Also, if you enjoy our podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Academic Dean is sponsored by Myers-McRae Executive Search and Consulting. Thanks again for tuning in. Until next time.